Chapter 9. Be Best. I laid low through the spring of 2017, healing from my surgeries, detoxing from the pain medication, but Melania and I stayed in touch, texting and sending links to articles and information daily. She made it clear to me that she wanted me back in the East Wing as soon as possible. I missed the adrenaline and the feeling that what I did really mattered. From New York, barely able to speak, I renewed my commitment to Melania and the Office of the First Lady and promised that I'd do my best on her initiative and as her friend. Grisham contacted me in the middle of June. We still haven't officially met, but I wanted to reach out and say I really hope you are feeling better and hopefully we get to meet sometime soon. Al Dente. In June 2017, David and I attended the wedding of Steve Mnuchin and his third wife, Louise Linton, at the Andrew W. Mellon Auditorium in Washington, D.C. The wedding was my first trip back to D.C. post-op, so it was sort of like a reunion. So many familiar faces, not all of whom I was thrilled to see. Full disclosure, Mnuchin's second wife, Heather, the mother of his children, is a very good friend of mine, and I asked her if it would upset her if I attended his wedding. Her response? She was fine with it. She's as good as it gets. I didn't make time to go to the dentist before the nuptials and was wearing my two temporary front teeth, one implant and one cap, what David called my chompers. My real teeth were knocked out in a childhood accident. My dentist had wanted me back in his chair months earlier, the day of my Jean-Georges lunch with Melania and Rachel, which was impossible. When I asked him if I could wear the falsies just a little bit longer, he said, "Bring Polident." Following the ceremony, I went to the bar and got a drink. I took one sip, and when I looked up, Brad Parscale, Trump's digital mastermind, whom I'd worked with during the inauguration, was standing right in front of me. He said, "How are you? I heard you had an operation." I'd started to say, "Actually, I had two," when my temporary tooth went flying out of my mouth. I'm not so sure who turned a brighter shade of red, Brad or me. I picked up my tooth off the dirty floor, placed it in my mouth, and said, "I'll be right back." I was mortified. I kept my head down, hoping not to be stopped by anyone else. I spotted Stephen and Heather's oldest child, Emma, whom I've known since her birth, and she helped me avoid a stop and chat with Ivanka, of all people. When I found David, I grabbed him by the arm and said, "Follow me." He knew there were at least 100 reasons why I'd want to ditch the shindig and asked, "What happened?" Once we were out of sight of the reception crowd, I took the tooth from my mouth and smiled at him, big gap showing. He said, "Let's go. I'll get your coat." "No, we have to stay. We're at Donald and Melania's table. They can't have empty chairs." This was an inner circle event, and it would be glaringly obvious if we were missing. In the bathroom, I washed my temporary tooth in hot water, put it under the blower for a hot second, dried it off, and placed it carefully back in my mouth, and then we went back upstairs to our table for dinner. Along with Donald and Melania, we sat with Thomas Barrack and his girlfriend, C.O. Solar, Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, a South African biotech multi-billionaire, owner of the Los Angeles Times, and a minority owner of the L.A. Lakers, who people said had met with Trump advisors about replacing the Affordable Care Act and a possible role as health care czar. His wife, Michelle Chan, president of Nant Studio, and Karen and Richard Lefrak, who was heading up Trump's new infrastructure council with real estate investor Steve Roth. Cozy. Dinner was served. I spent the entire meal with my index finger on my lip, holding my tooth in place. I tried not to smile and didn't do too much talking. After Melania and Donald had gone for the evening, everyone loosened up. I was happy to see Tom. I leaned over David's lap to hear their conversation. Tom looked at me, his smile contagious. I told myself not to smile back. David, sitting in between us, started telling Tom what happened earlier with Brad, and I laughed so hard, my tooth went flying out again and hit Tom right on his bald head. We were all cracking up. Tom was a sport about it. The next morning, David got me crazy glue from a drugstore, and I glued my tooth back in place before heading over to the White House. David and I spent the afternoon with Melania at the White House residence. Sitting in the West Sitting Hall, we rehashed the whole tooth saga. I was laughing so hard when I described the expression on Tom's face when the incisor bounced off his head that my tooth fell out yet again. Best comic timing of any artificial body part ever. I started to shove it back in, but Melania said, "What does it matter? Just leave it out." She could be so cool, so unfazed by things that would make others, including myself, cringe. So I did as she asked, and the three of us sat in the residence gossiping about the wedding, while I whistled through my gap. Melania and I talked about next steps on the initiative, too, until Donald returned from playing a round of golf. I quickly reinserted my tooth. I didn't care if Melania saw me like that, but Donald would have been taken aback. Fortunately, he was so busy talking about himself, I didn't have to say a word. Laughing together like that and being comfortable enough with her that I could be toothless and that she would even welcome it reminded me what I loved about Melania and why I needed to keep working with her. Welcome back. If you judge solely by texts, Lindsay Reynolds was excited to have me back in the East Wing. Welcome back, she texted that summer, with love yous galore. But deep down in her heart, I bet bigly that she would have been happy never to see me again. When I returned to the East Wing, the team was back together. It was great to see Lindsay, Ricky, Vanessa, Emily, Tim, Stephanie Grisham, and Mary Kate congregating in one room. We were all there for the same reason, to take care of FLOTUS. Lindsay told me I negotiated a great deal. She traded Melania's gift wrapping room in the East Wing to the military office in exchange for upgrading Melania's plane. Granted, the plane had been a real bone of contention, but we'd been guarding every inch of office space for Melania. When the initiative got rolling, we'd need all of it. And Lindsay had just given away a prime piece of White House real estate behind the First Lady's back. Melania loved the military, but she was none too happy to lose her gift wrapping room. I was furious. No one should go behind the First Lady's back. Melania was puzzled when she heard, and Lindsay was mad that I told Melania. It was like junior high, but with much higher stakes. With Pamela's help, Melania and I created a wish list of candidates for key positions, like Director of Communications and perhaps a new Chief of Staff. The list included Millie Hallow, an executive at the National Rifle Association, and, for the position of Director of Policy, Kaylee McEnany, a graduate of Georgetown and Harvard Law, a veteran of the George W. Bush administration, and a CNN contributor. McEnany was more interested in being the First Lady's Chief of Staff, and she certainly was qualified. But Melania had gotten used to Lindsay. She really liked McEnany, though, especially her law degree. So without deciding on a specific role, we notified the West Wing that they should begin the vetting process. Of course, we got into the weeds with them yet again about salary and title. The vetting took forever, and it became apparent that the West Wing wasn't doing anything to speed it along. During the intervening months, McEnany was writing a book, What Became 2018's The New American Revolution, The Making of a Populist Movement, and was leaving CNN, not to be a senior advisor in the First Lady's office, though. She'd been offered the job of national spokesperson for the Republican National Committee. Melania texted, she preferred to do this than being my senior advisor? Seriously? I called McEnany to ask, what happened? She said, I met with the family and they wanted me to be their spokesperson. The family, Ivanka's phrase. They were meeting with her behind our backs after we sent her name to the West Wing to be vetted. Melania and I were livid. Did you ask Ivanka if it was the same position or a different position than the East Wing was looking into for you? No, she said. I just assumed the family meant all of them. The family was Ivanka, the only Trump given the power of the purse, and she had offered Kaylee a job. I explained to Melania what happened and how the West Wing had thwarted us again. She texted, you know how they are snakes. They were that and so much more. Melania still couldn't believe Kaylee had chosen the family over her and texted, newscaster, flush-faced emoji. She is currently the White House press secretary. Ivanka was a serial poacher. She diverted McEnany and hired Mercedes Schlapp out from under us. And she'd installed Stephanie Grisham in the East Wing to keep an eye on things and isolate Melania. The pattern had clearly emerged. Princess wanted to render Melania irrelevant. In July, Melania finally agreed to pay Hervé Pierre a monthly salary, albeit one that was far less than he'd received at previous jobs. The package was not retroactive to include the 7 months he'd been working for her, nor would he be given a credit card or access badge. She did reimburse him for months of taxis, though. He said he would not be paid for original creations, just the labor of creating them and for the fabrics. I suggested he had a commission for the garments he scouted and purchased on her behalf, which is standard for stylists. He refused to do it. I remember saying to Melania that his agreement was low, considering she spends $20,000 on a single dress off the rack. She said, "No, it's good. It's a lot." He must have accepted the situation or figured out a way to work around it, because he stuck with Melania and is still working with her today. I never asked Hervé why he stayed, despite his agony over the money. I didn't need to. I clung to the East Wing too, just like he did. We did it for her. Get your narrative straight. On August 7th, Tom Barrack, John Reynaga, and I had a conference call about the financing and accounting of the Presidential Inaugural Committee, PIC. Tom said he was preparing to release the Form 990. "The what?" I asked. "Form 990 is the mandatory tax return filed with the Internal Revenue Service, revealing the expenses associated with the planning of the inauguration." "What was the total raised?" John asked. "Somewhere between $107 and $112 million, Tom said. "Cool, cool," John replied. "So what did he need to talk to us about?" Tom said, "I just wanted to touch base and let you know what's been going on." John interrupted, "Tom, I want to make sure you know on March 26, 2017, while Stephanie was in the hospital, Mel and I sent the PIC, Douglas Aramin and Heather Martin, Wiz's fully audited accounting report with every expenditure down to the penny." "Yes, got that," Tom said. "This is what I need from you." "Sure," John said. "Okay," I replied. "What I need from you is a one-pager," said Tom. "No reason to hide the ball. We just want to be upfront about the spending. It won't be an issue if we have the one-pager we all agree on." Agree on? The math was the math. There was nothing to agree about. He said, "We need to take care of this, so there's no issue with Stephanie in the press." Me? What the fuck was he talking about? Why would the press even mention my name? John said, "I thought the 990 only listed the vendors." "Right," Tom said. "Just the top five vendors." "Just the names of the companies, right? Not individuals," I asked. I wanted to know why I would be part of the conversation. Why would the press ask about me? John said, "Do you mean our friendship with the First Lady might be seen as cronyism?" Tom said, "There's that potential and we need to take care of it and make sure nepotism or cronyism doesn't come up. That's why we need to do this correctly now. So if that comes up, I will say, hell no." But Ivanka was the one who had brought me in, and we were not friends. John and I hung up with Tom, and for the first time, I felt a little scared. I didn't know everything that was going on, nor did I understand it at the time. But I mentally pushed aside a nagging worry about the one-pager. I was back at work and fully engaged with Melania. The Storm Stilettos. In August 2017, Melania and Donald traveled to Corpus Christi, Texas, to view the damage done by Hurricane Harvey. Melania wore Manolo Blahnik stiletto heels from the White House to Air Force One, setting off a storm of her own. Headlines like this one from Vanity Fair asked, "Who wears stilettos to a hurricane?" Inappropriate footwear would be the death of her. The story behind Melania's storm stilettos, or flood heels, has more to do with office politics than shoes. By the summer of Donald's first year as president, Melania had had enough of the West Wing's expectation that she'd drop everything to be available at a moment's notice for her husband. Part of her resentment about it had to do with the West Wing's glacial pace whenever she asked for anything from them. Everything she did was met with the same resistance: sending a press release, hiring staff, a contract, hello, granting interviews. Everything had to be approved by the West Wing, and they moved at the speed of continental drift on all of her requests. The only way Melania could exert any power was by saying no. She wasn't going to cancel a facial because Hope Hicks or General John Kelly, Donald's new chief of staff, asked her to, say, accompany her husband on a tour of a storm-ravaged region, shake hands, and throw paper towels so that he'd appear to be caring and human. Her reply, which she relayed through Lindsay and which eventually got to me, was to say that she couldn't possibly be ready to get on a plane without several days' advance warning. Does it take 3 days to pack for a 4-hour trip? No, but that was not the point. My perspective on these power games was that every time Melania said no, it gave Ivanka a chance to step into her place. I begged Melania to be more flexible about certain requests, like going to Texas. She hesitated, but she knew it was the right thing to do. That day, her en route to the airport, Manolo's and bomber jacket look was outfit number one. She changed on the plane into outfit number two, different pants and blinding white tennis shoes that obviously never been worn before. Even if she'd thought for a second that her stiletto heels would cause controversy, she wouldn't have cared. She liked how she looked, and that was that. Ronald Reagan always wore a suit to the Oval Office out of respect for his position, she would say. It's the same thing. Soon after, Melania and Donald made another catastrophe-related trip to San Juan, Puerto Rico. The island had been devastated by Hurricane Maria. The Trumps took their time before making that flight, which was controversial in and of itself. They flew to Red State, Texas, a day or two after Hurricane Harvey, but waited nearly 2 weeks before going to Puerto Rico. It looked bad. Between the two hurricanes, I thought a lot about rain boots and how the hell I was going to get her to wear them. I couldn't even begin to count the number of shoes she owned, but I wasn't so sure about a pair of rubber boots. I happened to be buying some cute Sorel ones for Alexi and me, and thought that Melania might like a pair too. "Have you seen the Sorel Joan Rain Wedge Chelsea?" I texted. "Love them." She said, "Send me pic." So I did, in 8 different colors. "I can't wait to hear what you say," squinting face with tongue emoji. "I can get you a pair." She said, "No, thank you. Love you." Face throwing a kiss emoji. Well, I tried. For the Puerto Rico trip, Melania's outfit number one, worn between the White House and Air Force One, was stilettos and cropped navy trousers. By the time they touched down in San Juan, she changed into outfit number two, just out of the box Timberland boots and white pants. Naturally, Twitter asked, "Who wears white pants to a city in rubble?" As far as Melania was concerned, it did not matter whether her clothing met whatever standard the public and media required, or whether it was appropriate for the weather, location, or occasion. Nothing mattered to her but her opinion of how she looked. And to be fair, she usually looked pretty great. Gratuity included. The impossible task of hiring qualified people only intensified my desire to get my role defined and made official. I still needed the help of a qualified person with political experience and was thrilled to enlist Pamela Gross again. She was fine with being an unsung, unpaid volunteer, too. Melania wasn't so keen about it at first, but Pamela said that she'd report directly to me. As she put it, "We are sure it's one voice and message and Melania is not bothered." Melania pushed for the contract on her end. She sent an email to Stefan that said, "Please contact Stephanie and Pamela. You need to work out the contract for both ASAP. I need them to work with me and connect with the right people on my behalf for my initiative. I am losing a lot of time to start with initiative. Thank you." My legal bills were mounting. I'd been working with 2 sets of lawyers, one from the firm Steptoe & Johnson and the other from Jones Day, who'd been negotiating a new contract with the White House legal team, Stefan Pazentino and Don McGahn. Naturally, the process took forever. On August 22, 2017, after many long months of waiting, my contract was executed. It was a first of its kind, White House gratuitous service agreement. I found out later that my lawyers had also represented various Trump-related entities. I wish I'd known sooner. The finer points. 1. I would volunteer as a trusted advisor. 2. My duties were limited to providing advice and guidance on policy initiatives, speeches, and social media as expressly requested by FLOTUS. 3. I was forbidden from interacting with third parties, journalists, etc., unless explicitly authorized by the Office of the First Lady and only as a trusted advisor or longtime friend, not as a member of Melania's office, the White House, or the U.S. government. 4. I'd submit to being investigated by the FBI and 5. The agreement could be discontinued at any time or for any reason by myself or at the sole discretion of FLOTUS. I paid my and Trump's lawyers tens of thousands of dollars for the privilege of working my ass off for free without acknowledgement, under intense scrutiny, with no job security. It was a legal muzzle that only made the job of launching the initiative harder. Unless Melania gave me written permission, I couldn't speak for the office of the First Lady. Melania wrote an email that permitted me to speak with and meet experts about her initiative, which she did the very next day after I signed my gratuitous service agreement. It was absurd, and yet I'd fought to make this happen. I was thrilled it was finally done. I definitely have a few screws loose. In a move of pure genius, Pamela used the exact same gratuitous service agreement my lawyers created for me, so the legal eagles in the White House couldn't object. The girls in the East Wing were not Pamela fans. They asked me not to bring her around. Grisham complained that Pamela was too high maintenance and made too much noise in meetings. I didn't care what Lindsay and Grisham said about her. Pamela's heart was in the right place. She was there for the right reasons. She's brilliant, and I knew I could trust her. On September 2nd, before visiting a distribution center at First Church of Pearland in Texas, in an area hit hard by Hurricane Harvey, Melania was getting her Twitter locked and loaded. She asked me whether she should tweet, "The First Lady brought books, crayons, and games for children," or "for children who have nothing left." For children, period. "Those kids will be so happy to have you, your smile and hugs today," I said. "Love you." I gave her two recommendations for what she should tweet. Option one, "So happy to have spent the day with the wonderful families helping each other after Hurricane Harvey, with a picture of you and a child." Option two, "I was so honored to meet so many heroes who have saved thousands of lives in Texas, with photo of rescue workers or Coast Guard." Melania's response, "Got it. Thank you. Love you." Kate Bennett was on the beat, writing a CNN story about Melania and on a hard deadline. I made a call to get her deadline extended. I asked Melania, "Do you want to tell Grisham the deadline was extended, or should Kate?" Playing the diplomat, Melania said, "Kate should reach out to SG. She told me Grisham would not have been able to extend a deadline in that way. If Grisham knew I'd been working with Bennett behind her back, she would have had a conniption. Children first. We must have come up with 100 names for Melania's initiative. I bought dozens of domain names on GoDaddy on my own dime. All rejected. Children first? Too much like America first. Shield your children? Don't like shield. Be a cyber buddy. Don't like buddy. Too casual. Protect our children. Too long. Speak up. Nope. I pushed Let's Talk, a natural continuation of Michelle Obama's Let's Move. But Melania rejected anything that would remind people of someone else. It had to be original, hers alone. The biggest issue with creating a program about the emotional wellness and mindfulness of children was the president. He bullied everyone. Ironically, the guiding quote we used for the initiative from the very beginning came from Frederick Douglass. "It's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men." Donald was the walking antithesis of what we were trying to create. There was no way for Melania to present her initiative to the world without first accepting the obvious about her husband's profile. She knew she'd get roasted about her anti-cyberbullying agenda. It was evident that cyberbullying caused life-threatening depression and suicidal ideation in teens and kids. And yet, her husband was an adult offender. I'd warned her about what the reaction would be if she focused solely on cyber. She texted, "I already know the reaction. Start at home." My intentions with the initiatives were always pure. I've dedicated my life to supporting children's causes. This is personal for me. Always has been. Always will be. I wanted it to be personal for Melania, too. While we were talking about mental health issues in kids, I asked her, "Do you think Donald has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder?" Children with ADHD have symptoms that include difficulty forming and maintaining friendships, a limited ability to develop social skills by observing others, failure to notice social cues, impulsive behavior, and a tendency to engage in disruptive behavior. What I should have really asked her was, "Do you think Donald has borderline personality disorder?" Symptoms include having no empathy or flexibility and rigidly clinging to problematic beliefs and behaviors that are way outside societal norms. She laughed at my question and said, "ADHD what? Are you kidding me?" I was dead serious. I know what ADHD looks and feels like. I've been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and expressive language disorder. At times, I find myself at a loss for words, which, if you had heard me ramble, might seem impossible. I said, if Donald actually went on television and said to the world, I've got it, it would be huge. Imagine the impact it would have in our society. I wasn't only referring to raising awareness for ADHD. His owning up to a disorder would explain his impulsiveness and inability to stop tweeting and saying stupid things. Then she really laughed. Boys will be boys, she said. They're all like that. I laughed along, but I knew not all boys behaved like Donald. The irony of ironies? I was working with Melania on an initiative to promote social and emotional well-being and awareness through educating kids about how to express their feelings when she so rarely expressed her own. Her emotional reticence and blanket acceptance of Donald's behavior in public will never change. I had to tread lightly and keep looking for cracks in her armor and opportunities to overcome the obstacles we faced. We needed experts to help try to shape her into a champion of emotional health and wellness. Pam and I enlisted some heavy hitters, a group of dynamic forward thinkers, the most highly regarded professors and leaders in the field of social and emotional learning, SEL, with 25 years worth of scientific evidence-based research backing them up. These superstars included Mark Brackett, PhD, director of the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence, and Robin Stern, PhD, the Yale Center's associate director. Our ultimate goal was to use Melania's platform to incorporate SEL into the curriculum of every public elementary school in America. We wanted children to learn how to express themselves, and her primary focus was in their well-being. These were serious people, and they weren't going to be involved in anything they couldn't be proud of. The First Lady's initiative had to live up to its promise. Melania believed children were America's most valuable asset, and that it was their right to feel safe and supported. We declared, "Let's make America care again, especially for America's most valuable asset and our collective brighter future, our children." This comprehensive and multifaceted vision to teach children how to care for themselves and society was based on several systems that had been researched and developed by experts in the fields of psychology and education and implemented with the support of think tanks and community leaders around the world, including the Aspen Institute, the Center for Advanced Strategic Leadership, and Yale University's Center for Emotional Intelligence. These scientific, evidence-based approaches concluded that developing the tools and skills of SEL and emotional intelligence, starting when children are toddlers, leads to greater well-being and the freedom to make your own choices at an early age. Mark and Robin sat down with Melania, Pamela, and me at the penthouse in Trump Tower and explained how decades of research has proven, with these tools, that children and adults alike learn how to feel, which in turn enables them to know what to say and how to say it. It was simple and yet profound. To prove its effectiveness and relatability, I was the first guinea pig. I opened up and shared my life's journey with Mark and Robin, expressing how I'd learned many coping mechanisms. What they taught me was that, without first being able to identify my emotions and accept and express my feelings, I wasn't self-aware. Further, because I didn't have the skills, at times I didn't know how to nurture and support myself, which I now see leads down a path of depression, isolation, and addictive behaviors. It was fascinating. After Mark and Robin brought us up to speed and Melania understood the power of this information, she was engaged and excited about the idea of adapting this multi-pronged approach as a part of her platform. She elaborated, "We must join together to protect all children from the terrible suffering caused by our opioid epidemic and unthinkable pain caused by bullying in all its many forms." Pamela, Melania, and I, and Zero support staff, along with our experts, refined the mission of the First Lady's as-yet-unnamed initiative. It had to be a platform, not a single issue, that was bipartisan, could rally and inspire the whole country, and encompassed a range of child and adolescent wellness issues, especially teaching kids how to express themselves. I remember saying to Melania, "We can use the line, children should be seen and heard." "What do you mean?" she asked. She'd never heard the common phrase before, that children should be seen and not heard. She grew up in a culture that taught kids to hide their feelings and show nothing. We presented her with Mark and Robin's compelling research that proved children who could learn to talk about their feelings and receive validation from parents and teachers were more confident and compassionate and grew into empathetic, considerate adults. Melania was warming to the idea. Her strength, that she cared deeply about her own child and was a loving mother, could be extrapolated to her caring about all children. Melania was motivated to create a successful platform that would resonate with American families and also tamp down some of her husband's more inflammatory chatter. Before an upcoming interview, I asked her how she would respond to the Donald question, and she said, "Don't care what they ask. I'll always answer what I want. They don't deserve more." Way to kick off our initiative about teaching non-combative communication skills with a great open attitude. The UN lunch. The September 20th, 2017 U.S. mission to the United Nations luncheon with the First Lady was traditionally intended for ambassadors and world leaders' spouses only. But if Melania was interested, we could invite individuals and experts from the private sector who we believe would be supportive of her initiative in the interest of children. She approved. Pamela and I reached out to our contacts. Those in attendance included Harold S. Kopowitz, founding president of the Child Mind Institute, philanthropist Ronald Lauder, Deborah Lee Furness of Hopeland, Dr. Shefali Salisbury, Dr. Mark Brackett, Dr. Robin Stern, philanthropists Allison Lutnick and Julia Koch, and, of course, Rachel Roy. The girls in the East Wing, especially Lindsay, Ricky, and Grisham, have been icing me out about the details, menu, press invites, State Department details, the things I used to handle. Their exclusion felt personal. And it was. I couldn't get access to the information or do anything on my own because I was locked out of my computer again. I apologized to Melania numerous times for bothering her about the details, but her guests were going to miss the State Department submission deadline. I explained I was being thwarted by people who didn't like me or didn't want me around, but I still needed to get things done. Melania asked, "Why do you allow yourself to care what they think about you?" I cared. A lot. I felt they were out to get me. Rachel, who'd had to send in her info at least twice, said, "Those people don't care about her. They just want their positions and titles. Melania needs you now more than ever. Friends that are family. That's what we are, through ups and downs." Grisham demanded that all requests go through her. This is typically how the press should be handled, but she and her obstructionist ways made me anxious. When I realized she hadn't invited Women's Wear Daily, I connected her directly to Rosemary Feidelberg. Grisham's response was, "I checked all my mailboxes and had White House IT do a search, but oddly, neither of your initial emails came through to me. That being said, we didn't connect until after the U.S. Secret Service deadline had passed." Was she kidding me? She didn't want WWD to cover the First Lady's appearance at the United Nations? Sure enough, almost 18 hours later, Grisham made it sound like she'd accomplished the impossible and wrote to Rosemary, "Great news, I was able to get you added to our press pool." Like all speechwriters, I helped Melania write her address, as directed by her, and even made a recording for her to use when she rehearsed. Melania did a good job on her delivery. "We must teach each child the values of empathy and communication that are at the core of the kindness, mindfulness, integrity, and leadership which can only be taught by example. By our own example, we must teach children to be good stewards of the world they will inherit. We must remember that they are watching and listening, so we must never miss an opportunity to teach life's many ethical lessons along the way. No child should ever feel hungry, stalked, frightened, terrorized, bullied, isolated, or afraid, with nowhere to turn." I noticed more than a few smirks in the room when she said children needed to be taught by example about kindness, integrity, and leadership. 3 days earlier, Donald had retweeted a manufactured gif of him hitting a golf ball into Hillary Clinton's back, knocking her down. The line, "No child should ever feel hungry," was also hard to swallow from a woman in a $3,000 hot pink dress by Del Pozo. During the hour she spent there, it would have been appropriate for Melania to work the room a bit. Instead, once all the guests were seated, she entered from the back of the room, walked straight up onto the stage, delivered the speech, and then made a beeline to her table. She left without shaking anyone's hand. She could have shown her respect to the guests by stopping at each table to say hello. I was bothered by that. We'd invited many of these people to meet her and sign on to be a part of this mission. When Katie Rogers of the New York Times asked her to comment on the rumor that I'd written Melania's speech, Grisham replied to her directly. "Mrs. Trump was the main driver on the content and subject matter of the speech. Stephanie Wolkoff contributed to the speech in her role as a consultant to the office of the First Lady, along with others." Finally, Grisham is doing her job, I thought. I was stuck because she called me a consultant, but per my contract, I was told I had to use the terms friend and trusted advisor. No idea why I'd spent tens of thousands of dollars on lawyers and more than 100 hours of time so I could call myself a friend. Made no sense. But I went with it to get my work done. Roger sent me a separate email saying she, Melania, seems to be growing into the job. I would love to hear whether that's true from someone who knows her as well as you do. She asked if I had at least partially been behind some of the more sophisticated messaging choices FLOTUS had been making lately, adding, her Twitter videos, for example, are heartfelt and seem effective. I also heard that you helped write her UN speech. Is that true? I forwarded it to Melania and wrote, please read this. Melania responded, please send me what you will send her. We'll look over. Thank you. Face throwing a kiss emoji. I forwarded Melania the following statement, which she had approved before. Mrs. Trump has welcomed the return of Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, the former Vogue director of special events and founding fashion director of Lincoln Center. Wolkoff was sidelined with a spinal fusion and away for several months after the inauguration and establishing the East Wing. Miss Wolkoff, a friend of Mrs. Trump's and one of her trusted advisors on her staff, has returned as a consultant in recent weeks to help advise the First Lady on her initiatives, events, messaging, and speechwriting. She works closely with Mrs. Trump on drafting her speeches and most recently for her speech at the United Nations. Miss Wolkoff remains based in New York City. Melania said, this is too much information. You should write her back that you were director with Vogue and that you are back as a consultant to the Office of the First Lady. We'll send you what SG sent already on the record, and you need to stick with that off the record. Her next email said, you want to say to her to keep you out of the story. Almost every politician works with a speechwriter, and certainly no one suspected that Melania was writing all of her own speeches without assistance, especially after her plagiarism debacle. And helping her craft speeches had always been a part of my job description. I started to sense that someone was trying to make it seem to Melania like I was attempting to undermine her, with my need for credit. I had my suspicions who it was. I was chastised by Stephanie Grisham a few days later for corresponding directly with Katie Rogers. She texted that I could only describe myself as a consultant. I replied that I'd only corrected some facts for her story, to which Grisham replied, tell her that is all wrong. She can't write it if you tell her she has facts wrong. This was how Grisham treated journalists, keeping them out of events and telling them they're wrong, even when they're not. I mentioned to Melania that Grisham was increasingly hostile and that Lindsay was chronically unprepared. Melania, shrugging emojied and said, they're here. If you want to come live here, great. What am I going to do? Stephanie Grisham started throwing her weight around and portrayed me as a cat among the pigeons, causing commotion, speaking to the press, and stepping out of line. But all I was a cat chasing her tail. I returned to the White House to assist the First Lady. I wanted to show up to work without being harassed or having to keep explaining who I was. If I didn't say I was there working for Melania, I wouldn't get past the front gate. What was I supposed to say? I was delivering a pizza? I couldn't help noticing a chill in the air between Melania and me. It had been on and off since the UN lunch. As quickly as Trump's wall on the Mexican border went up, so did Melania's. But hers was more impenetrable. Things were just different. Little did I know that the powers that be had concocted a brilliant plan that involved Melania and me, and the wheels were now in motion. The plan, in fact, had been in place for almost a year. The complex and destructive motivations and behaviors from all the personalities that joined the bandwagon made the dynamic of Melania and my relationship, once fenced off with boundaries and barriers, explode at the seams with intrigue, secrecy, and ultimately, betrayal. The next day, Melania reached out and told me, don't talk or meet with Nina Burley of Newsweek, whom I'd been planning on seeing for an off-the-record discussion. Attached was a screenshot of Burley's article about the recently released archives of Donald and Howard Stern's radio show, including the nugget, Trump says he got Melania for the right price, and he likes to grope her in public. On September 27th, Pamela and I were taken aback when Melania texted, doing a roundtable and listening session on opioids in the White House tomorrow. Addiction was a pillar of our initiative. Children turned to opioids and designer drugs as a coping mechanism. As she learned about the opioid epidemic, she said, reading all the stories and stats, scary. I wish we were going to be there, I said. Are you hosting it? Yes, she replied. You didn't want Pamela and me to come? Doing with the Presidential Opioid Commission, in the White House, not East Wing. Melania's first informational session was on Ivanka's turf. I texted Melania the day of the roundtable, big day for this initiative, wishing you all the best. What I really wanted to say was, why didn't you include Pamela and me? A couple of days later, I sent Melania an article from the New York Post headlined, White House Launches Probe into Private Email Accounts. We all knew that Ivanka used her personal email account for official business. Melania had explained to Rachel Roy and me at Trump Tower months ago, when Ivanka's email issue first came up, that it wouldn't be good for any of us. Pamela and I went to D.C. on October 3rd and 4th, and both mornings I had to text Melania, we can't get in. We were stuck outside the White House gate in so many ways. Failure to launch. Bad week for Melania. On October 10th, Donald's first wife, Ivana Trump, released her memoir about motherhood, Raising Trump, and told ABC News, I have the direct number to the White House, but I don't really want to call him there because Melania is there, and I don't really want to cause any kind of jealousy or something like that, because I'm basically first Trump wife, okay? I'm first lady, okay? When I saw the video, I texted Melania the unflattering photo of Ivana that was all over the news, which was mean girl of me, but I was only supporting my girl. I said, by commenting, you're promoting her book, you know that. Melania declared, no more Mar-a-Lago for her. Grisham issued the statement, Mrs. Trump has made the White House a home for Barron and the president. She loves living in Washington, D.C., and is honored by her role as First Lady of the United States. She plans to use her title and role to help children, not sell books. There's clearly no substance to this statement from an ex. This is unfortunately only attention-seeking and self-serving noise. On October 18th, Second Lady Karen Pence, a former art teacher, held a press conference at Florida State University in Tallahassee and presented her art therapy initiative with the cute motto, Healing with Heart. In her interview with Fox News, she explained that arts and crafts were proven to be beneficial for mental health and can be used to treat cancer, anxiety, eating disorders, and autism. In its coverage, Vogue reported, as a country patiently waits for First Lady Melania Trump to actually begin implementing her murky anti-cyberbullying agenda, starting presumably with her own husband, Second Lady Karen Pence has beaten her to the punch, formally announcing today that her chosen cause will be art therapy. Keep in mind that Karen Pence was not a threat to Ivanka. She also had a qualified staff and prior personal experience doing art therapy. We had no staff. There was nothing in Melania's history or experience to form the basis of our program, and we were fighting resistance from the forces in the East Wing and West Wing. Melania wanted to launch. She was frustrated that she hadn't. Pamela and I would meet with Dr. Mark Brackett and Dr. Robin Stern with and without Melania, and we'd go back and forth with presentations about using the RULER method, recognizing, understanding, labeling, expressing, and regulating, to teach SEL in an educational environment starting in kindergarten. Since all of us were helping the First Lady without a budget, we figured out a way to launch her initiative without one. We were undecided if we should launch in partnership with the Department of Health and Human Services or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We had no budget and no support, but we plowed forward. The initiative was now known as Be Best. Melania had come up with that. I warned her that the phrase sounded illiterate. What about changing it to be the best or be your best? No. Melania, lover of Sharpies, drew the two-word logo with block letters and said, I drew it myself, so no one can say I plagiarized it. As the days went on, I felt less and less in touch with the East Wing. I knew I was being squeezed out. They no longer included me in meetings or agenda items and would occasionally send me dribs and drabs of information. Melania kept up our friendship, but was mostly focused on making sure I delivered all aspects of everything Be Best related. Despite feeling marginalized, I did deliver everything to her. I presented the ideas and still hoped, at the very least, they'd be executed. And all of our efforts would bear fruit, whether I was involved or not. Although I had my doubts that anyone running the East Wing would know how to implement any of it, I gave it all to them. Hopefully, Melania would do some good with her position as First Lady, which was why I got involved in the first place, At least there'd be something to show for it. Every time Melania's name appeared in the press, Stephanie Grisham's name was right there with it. Pamela sent me the link to Kate Bennett's article, "Melania Trump Does Things Her Way," with Grisham's name all over it. Pamela said, "Grisham is building her brand on Bella's back, the chutzpah." Melania was distant, not always replying to my messages. She asked me to delete our texts, reminding me that it was no one's business what we talked about. Hervé gets his moment. On October 20th, Melania and Hervé Pierre went to the ceremony at the National Museum of American History, where the First Lady formally presented the gown they'd collaborated on for the inaugural balls to the Smithsonian's First Lady's collection. I would have loved to attend, but I wasn't really invited. Melania told me, "Come if you want," a few days before. Instead, I offered to help her write her speech. She said, "I have my remarks." Grisham must have written them. With some hesitation, I emailed Grisham, suggesting that she invite WWD to cover the Smithsonian presentation exclusively. Instead of just sending me a press invitation to forward to WWD, Grisham sent me a link with info about the event, but I couldn't open it on my government phone. I went back to her, and she blew me off. "I'm too busy preparing for the Asia trip," she wrote. Soon, Melania was going to be in Tokyo and Seoul, traveling the world without a care. I asked Melania directly about a WWD exclusive. She said, "Yes, I talked to Grisham. Won't give an exclusive to WWD. My statement will go out to everyone." Grisham's reasoning was that no one would get an exclusive interview with the First Lady. Was she a press secretary or a prison warden? I knew the answer to that. The East Wing felt more like a jail every day. I told Melania, "Just so you know, I suggested WWD because they have been a part of your fashion legacy since the inauguration. Never mind if Grisham said no. I think they should be invited, like all the other press." "They can be invited, but no Q&A. Well, at least I tried. I had been part of the collaboration between Hervé and Melania, but I wasn't included in their celebration. Melania's speech was brief. "To be honest, what I would wear to the inaugural ball was the last thing on my mind," she said, though of course it had been item number one on her to-do list. Poor Hervé was given only 2 weeks to design and produce this couture piece. We had never worked together before, but I knew of his stellar reputation and wanted to work with someone who would do more than just design a dress. I wanted to work with someone who would be willing to collaborate with me. And Hervé exceeded my expectations. I was so pleased with our end results, and it is my hope that this piece is one of the many great beginnings of our family's history here in Washington, D.C. Thank you all for being with me here today. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America. The Melania I knew would never say, "our family." That's Ivanka speak. Hervé, beaming, stood next to her in front of the gown, which was displayed in a glass box, and I was thrilled for him. Hervé sweetly reached out to thank me. On October 26th, Melania told me that the ceremony was no big deal. Instead, we talked about Anna Wintour's appearance on The Late Late Show with James Corden. He asked her, "Who would you never invite back to the Met?" Her answer, "Donald Trump." Melania said, "Oh, we are crying." 3 laughing crying emojis. The Justice Department Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation was heating up. It was rumored 2 indictments were going to be served. Melania and I had our hunches about one of them. On October 30th, news broke that Rick Gates, yes, that Rick Gates, the one who Donald said he didn't know in his living room at Trump Tower over a year before, Trump's former deputy campaign chairman and deputy chairman for the 50th presidential inauguration, and Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign chairman, were charged with 12 counts that included conspiracy against the United States, conspiracy to launder money, and acting as an unregistered agent of a foreign principal. Trump Show. On November 16th, 2017, Melania and I were flying to New York on her plane, along with her parents, when I showed her a New York Post article titled, "Trump to Lift Ban on Importing Elephant Trophies from Africa." The Fish and Wildlife Service had something to do with it, but for the most part, Trump was to blame. The family strikes again. "Such cruelty. The brutality of killing elephants, it's horrifying," I said. "The boys should be ashamed of themselves." The story gave credit where it was due. President Trump has decided to let big game hunters like sons Eric and Donald Jr. import the heads of elephants into the United States, reversing an Obama-era ban from 2014. The National Rifle Association trumpeted the decision. Melania was not sympathetic to the boys, lobbying efforts for guns and hunting, or the bizarre need to hang a dead animal head on the wall. That night, she did some lobbying of her own, and her plea directly to Donald actually worked. It didn't always, but this time, thankfully it did. The next day, Trump tweeted, "Put big game trophy decision on hold until such time as I review all conservation facts." The sudden change of heart was because of Melania, not because of pressure from foreign governments or Ellen DeGeneres or his seeing gruesome animal slaughter images on the internet. I felt proud to have had something to do with it. She was able to make a difference that day and would have done so much more had she not been derailed so often, so aggressively. Another one bites the dust. Tim Trapeppi had been warned over the last 9 months about bandying about Melania's name. He'd hired his friend to do advance work with him and gotten in screaming matches with Lindsay and Ricky about his not doing his job and spending way too much time kissing ass in the West Wing and feeding them lots of intel. So Melania fired him. He wrote me an apologetic email on November 16, 2017. "I'm sure you heard about today. I'm sorry it didn't work out with me and Lindsay. I hope I didn't let down FLOTUS, but I always had her best interest first. I just want to thank you for the greatest experience of my life working for her. I would have never had that opportunity without you, and I will always be indebted to you. If ever I can be of assistance to you, please don't hesitate to reach out to me." I wasn't surprised he'd been let go, and I thought to myself, better him than me. What's the story? On December 8th, Tom Barrack followed up with John Reynaga and me about the Form 990. Tom told us it hadn't yet been filed. After some small talk, Tom said, "John, what I need from you is the story, the narrative. The press is going to say, Obama's cost X, so why did ours cost Y? The narrative we'd heard was, the broadcast was so expensive because we didn't have any underwriters or sponsors. The pick paid for it itself. So I didn't understand the question." John said, "Do you mean about the events that fell under Wiz and Inaugural Productions, or the other events?" I chimed in, "All 18 events?" I didn't really understand what he wanted from us. The Wiz accounting was done. "I'm not asking you to invent it," said Tom, "but I need you to write a one-pager about Wiz's spending on the events and on the broadcast." Again with the one-pager? Back in August, John and I'd had the same conversation with Tom. "Does this have anything to do with Rick Gates?" asked John. "Gates?" asked Tom. I was in a time warp. He sounded just like Donald had that night in Trump Tower. "No. That's about Paul Manafort in Ukraine. No questions have been raised about the pick. Not yet, anyway. I want you to give me the narrative you want to see on the cover of the Washington Post," he said. "We need a narrative, not numbers." Instantly, my stomach clenched. He was the chairman and had approved and signed off on everything. Why did he need us to write a one-pager on our scope of work? I hung up the phone more confused than ever. I looked John dead in the eyes and said, "I'd never even seen the numbers. I'd never seen the audited budgets sent to the Presidential Inauguration Committee. I'd been in the hospital when Wiz Media Partners prepared them and sent them in. I couldn't even tell you what bank Wiz used. I had no signatory powers." "I'll talk to Mel and get back to you," John said before heading out. At 3:07 p.m., I received an email from John saying, "Knock yourself out." The subject line? Forward, Presidential Inaugural Broadcast Events. Calendar, budget, budget assumptions, version 3. Forwarded from Chris Wagner of Inaugural Productions, with the approved bottom line of $24,805,499. I told my Wiz partners, John and Mel, "Meet me at my lawyer's office to explain the finances." I hadn't been privy to them all. The whole thing was so upsetting. I was worried about seeing Tom Barrack at the White House Christmas party. I told Melania I was considering not going. She asked, "Hope you are not stressing it out about TB. I hope your headaches go away soon." I was awake until 5 a.m. preparing all the paperwork Tom requested. I said, "I think it best for me not to be there to see him. I love you." Melania said, "Go to rest. Don't give up your life because of him. Love you." Heart emoji. Instead, I went with David and the kids to an intimate friends and family party at the White House on the weekend of December 2nd. Zachary and Tyler were running free around the White House with Barron, making a stop in the Oval Office. After a ballet performance, David, Alexi, and I joined Melania, Donald, Phil Ruffin and his wife, Alexandra, and Rachel Roy upstairs in the residence living room for lunch, where we ate shrimp cocktail and pigs in a blanket. When Zachary and Tyler joined us, Tyler whispered in my ear, "Did you know the president has a red button on his desk to order Diet Cokes?" We laughed. "No," I said. The president, David, and Mr. Ruffin were talking politics. Donald asked David, "What do you think of Rex Tillerson?" David said, "I thought he was okay." Donald was silent. He then asked, "What do you think of Nikki Haley?" David told him, "I think she's a rock star." Donald nodded and smiled. He was also very interested in knowing what David thought about moving our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I heard David say, "That's a very bold move." Mr. Ruffin interjected, "We should negotiate more before we move the embassy." David said, "I didn't know we were negotiating." Fire and Fury. On January 2nd, 2018, I was back in New York. I was relieved we'd finally hired a policy director, our go-to inside the White House, Regan Thompson. She'd been an executive assistant on the National Security Council and served as a communications and policy advisor for then-Congressman Mike Pompeo. After I FaceTimed her several times, I told Melania that Regan would be a great middleman for Pamela and me in dealing with the East Wing and White House, especially with her experience on the Hill. I needed to spend time catching up on my life. I had 4,541 unopened emails, 213 unopened text messages, and 140 voicemails to listen to. I was on a mission to get my own paperwork done. That lasted about 30 minutes before I got sidetracked. I texted Melania, "What are you doing?" "Working on pictures for albums of all of my trips, and if I don't do now, we'll never do." I stared at the word albums for a good 5 seconds. So that was what she'd been up to. Albuming. I thought to myself, "Want to switch jobs?" "I still don't have a wedding album," she wrote. I didn't either. Albuming seemed fun, actually. No wonder she was so excited about it. "I wish you were next door so I could come in." Pensive face emoji, I wrote. She said, thumbs up sign emoji, smiling face with blushed cheeks emoji. "Move to DC. It is beautiful here. Don't miss NYC at all." The next day, Melania reached out. "Did you send papers to TB, Tom Barrack? He is still calling?" I told her John and Mel are still working on them. About 5 minutes later, Katie Rogers of the New York Times got in touch with me about the recent book release that had captivated the nation, Fire and Fury, the White House expose by Michael Wolff. In the book, he wrote that Melania hadn't wanted Donald to run and that she'd been crying bitter tears on election night. Rogers said, "I was just wondering if you had any idea if that was actually true." I asked Melania how to respond. "Say it is not true," she told me. "Whatever is about MT in the book is total fiction. Never happened. Wonder where they get all this info. They don't know real MT. Like DJT, MT sometimes spoke about herself in the third person." Melania and I revised her statement, and after her approval, I answered Rogers' question. She was neither crying nor surprised on election night. She and Donald worked very hard to achieve victory on election night. In her article, Rogers wrote, "Nearly a year into her tenure as First Lady, and after a week of intense scrutiny prompted by a new book that claims she had dreaded life in the White House, Melania Trump has hired a director of policy to advance her nascent platform. On Thursday, the White House announced the First Lady's choice, Regan Thompson, 27 years old. It seemed to imply that Thompson had been hired to oversee the initiatives in response to Fire and Fury. Not true. I texted FLOTUS. "The fact that no one knows we've been working with you for almost a year on your initiative is absurd. That's why these articles come out. It sounds like you hired an inexperienced 27-year-old. Melania replied, "Are you surprised they wrote that? What did you expect from NYT and Katie? Do you want to be announced in the press? Or that is a stupid question. smiling face with blushed cheeks emoji. I Googled your name and is saying senior advisor. Now they say trusted advisor. And why is she hired again? The truth would have been nice for once. Press outlets had mentioned me as Melania's advisor since the inauguration. But in all this time, the White House had never announced me. My reply? Whatever you think. I knew no one in either wing of the White House was going to allow her to put my name on a press release. They hadn't yet, so why would they now? No one wanted the truth about all the work we'd done to come out. She wrote, I feel it means a lot to you that you are announced. I will talk to legal again. As per now, they said because of different contract and contractors form, and as a volunteer, legally cannot be formally announced. We'll try again. XO heart emoji. If I hadn't been prohibited by my non-disclosure agreement from speaking with the media as Melania's trusted advisor, the American people would have known about the initiative, our working with experts, and what Regan Thompson's role was. It was almost midnight. I texted confused face emoji and went to sleep. In the morning, I found her reply text. I want you are happy. I feel you are not. Confused face emoji. I fight my best but can't go against the law. Love you. Kiss emoji. What the fuck were they telling her? Against the law? What law would it break to share the work we'd been doing? On January 12, 2018, a week before Donald and Melania's 13th wedding anniversary, a Wall Street Journal article, Trump lawyer arranged $130,000 payment for adult film star Silence, reported that a woman named Stephanie Clifford, a.k.a. porn star Stormy Daniels, had received a secret payoff from Michael Cohen in October 2016, around the time of the Pussy tape reveal, to keep quiet about having sex with Donald in 2006, when Barron was just a baby. I sent Melania an urgent text. She didn't reply all day. I was horrified by the Stormy Daniels story, and Michael Cohen was in deep, deep shit. When Melania finally replied, she wrote off the story and said, "It's just politics." That year on my birthday, Melania sent me the usual white orchid, as well as a luxurious Louis Vuitton travel case just like the one she had. It was very thoughtful of her. Not listening. Melania gave Pamela and me permission to host an official lunch meeting in the East Wing on behalf of the First Lady's initiatives. I set it up to coincide with a conference when all of the experts were going to be in D.C. already, so we wouldn't need to pay for their travel. Ricky told me that there was no budget to pay for the expert lunch. It was just a dozen people. I offered to pay for sandwiches and sodas myself. Instead of greeting these experts with open arms as they came into the East Wing, Stefan Pazantino, who was suddenly involved, kicked things off by dismissing the First Lady's guests. He handed out a memo that said, "The First Lady is seeking information and perspectives from a diverse range of thought leaders to provide her with insights and perspective regarding issues that are of great importance to her. These individuals will not, however, be making policy recommendations to the First Lady or the President in the form of a council, an advisory committee, a commission, or through subcommittees." I was mortified. He basically said, "You can talk all you want, but none of what you say will ever be used or credited." Par for the course. Never forget. In late January, Melania was supposed to join Donald in Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum, the annual gathering where billionaires talk about how to rule the world. Grisham's statement about why FLOTUS decided at the last minute to blow off Davos was, "It was determined there were too many scheduling and logistical issues, so Mrs. Trump will not travel to Davos." Many speculated that Melania wasn't going because she was furious about Stormy Daniels. She told me she didn't feel like going and just waiting around. So what would the First Lady do instead? On January 25th, she went to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. International Holocaust Remembrance Day was a few days away. The visit was politically acceptable and close to home, and she could control it completely. Melania asked me to come with her and her mother. I was supposed to be on a flight back to New York, but I stayed for that. No press was invited, which was how things were done now, with Grisham calling the shots. But the visit would be chronicled by the White House photographer. The museum director, Sarah Blumfeld, gave Melania a private tour, and the photographer captured every solemn moment. At one point, I nudged Mrs. Nobbs to stand with her daughter in a photo. Except for that one moment, Melania walked with Bloomfield, learning about the museum while the rest of us trailed behind. Melania knew that my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. I would have loved to have walked with her to hear what the museum director had to say about the exhibition. I'd stayed in D.C. just to follow her around, especially here, in a place that had meaning to me and my family. This push-pull feeling, the back and forth of her being cold on Monday and warm on Tuesday, asking me to come on an outing and then not including me in the museum director's tour, sending love you texts and then not replying to calls was wearing on me. At the time, the news cycle was about Melania's renegotiating her prenup with Donald, and the Stormy Daniels story only helped her cause. While Donald was in Davos, hobnobbing with elites, his wife would be remembering the 6 million dead, wearing black, and being strategically photographed alone against tragic backdrops as if she were a serious, solemn human being. At the Hall of Remembrance's Eternal Flame Memorial, Melania paused to light a candle at the starkly beautiful prayer wall. I thought of Bubby and Papa and missed them so viscerally, my throat and stomach tightened. Did Melania notice my emotion and call me over to light a candle with her for my grandparents? Nope. She was my friend, someone I loved, remembering people I'd loved before, acknowledging their survival and their suffering. Any normal person with a human heart would have understood why that was important to me. But I was coming to realize what was really important to her. She just wanted a picture to post on social media. As we rode back to the White House, I said, "That was hard for me. I miss my grandparents." Melania looked at me sympathetically. I said, "Thank you for bringing me with you today." And then she went back to looking at the images. Later that day, she posted a few of them and released a statement, written by Grisham, no doubt. "My thoughts and prayers are with the people whose lives and families were broken by the horrors of the Holocaust, but not with the person standing right behind her whose family had experienced those horrors." The White Suit. The Holocaust Memorial Museum was a rare outing for Melania in January 2018. The press assumed her not appearing in public had to do with shame about her husband's infidelity. The truth is, no one in the West Wing would dare apply pressure to her now to appear, and Melania wasn't offering. She had to go to the State of the Union address, though. We talked about what she'd wear for her re-entry into the public eye, and she had her heart set on a Christian Dior white suit with crop pants, a fitted jacket, and a ruffled blouse. "You cannot wear a white suit," I said. "You know that, right? I'm begging you not to wear a white suit." I enlisted Hervé to send texts to Melania that said the same thing. She was on to us, though, LOLing about how we were tag-teaming texting her to convince her to leave the Dior in the closet. Why was it so important that Melania Trump not wear a white suit to the State of the Union in 2018? For starters, the white suit was practically Hillary Clinton's trademark, the uniform of anti-Trumpers, a symbol of female empowerment, and the hashtag MeToo movement, which had exploded a few months earlier in October 2017. When reporters from the New York Times and the New Yorker exposed the serial assaults of movie producer Harvey Weinstein. If Melania wore a white suit, it would look like she was sending a coded message to the world. The press would go nuts for days with assorted hashtag Free Melania hot takes. We were trying to keep the focus on Be Best, which was within weeks of being presented to the world. Her ambiguously political fashion choices would be a distraction. The more I begged, the more she laughed it off, saying, "Oh, Stephanie, come on. I mean, really, get over it." She wore the Dior, and the media predictably twisted itself in knots trying to interpret the message of her ivory suit. I'll give her one thing. No one remembers a word of Donald's speech. All they remember is Melania's white suit.